Hey y'all, Sam here. Thanks for tuning into Party Girls. Feel free to follow us on Instagram at party.girls.pod and check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/partygirls, where you can subscribe to our show and become a member of our Discord community. Thanks, y'all.
Hey, everybody out there in Radio Land. Jamie here to tell you about a very exciting event that is being put on by the Wilani Defense Society of New York City, a group of which I am a part. We are going to have a combination report back strategy session and social for comrades, whoever wants to come, wherever you want to come from, you're welcome there. This is happening on April 11th, 6:30 p.m. until maybe go to like 10 or so whenever people start filtering out. It is in Williamsburg, convenient to the JMZ train as well as the L. And you're going to hear a little report back from the summit in Tucson from a member of the group, as well as we're going to have a structured discussion about strategy. And then there'll be some time for people to kind of mill around, hang out, talk, eat, drink, whatever. So if you want to know more details about this, including the address, which hasn't been released yet, follow Wilani Defense _NYC on Instagram to get all the 411. Hello and welcome to Party Girls, the communist podcast for intelligent slackers who hate having a boss. I'm Jamie Peck.
And I'm Sam Beard.
And happy powers combine.
Happy Easter, everybody. Jamie almost didn't let me say that.
Oh my goodness. This is a God-free zone, okay?
There's no such thing.
Oh, our first split. Here it is.
Here it is.
Well, okay. I think we have a cool, fun bit of housekeeping. So we have been putting this podcast together so far all by ourselves. And by we, I mean Sam, because I have zero aptitude for producing a podcast. And he's been like editing it and shit. But now we have our friend Andrew Calloway is our producer now. Say hello, Andrew.
Hey, all you party girls and folks. Nice to be, I don't know, mixing the show.
Hell yeah.
Incredibly grateful to have you here, Andrew. The sheer horror of going back and listening to the episodes that I edited and like hearing like a 12-second pause in the middle of the Inhabit episode like almost caused an ulcer. So I went back and listened to our one that you edited and it's pearled and it's spectacular and it just sounds better too. And I like don't, I'm assuming there's some engineering there, but
there's a little bit of EQ going on. You know, people forget that podcasting is labor.
Pod work is work.
And it's an honor. It's an honor and a privilege.
Aw.
And now I'm going to move backstage.
Aw. Thanks, man. Yeah, I met Andrew through DSA and we've kind of been friends since then. So it's nice to be working together. Yeah, I guess I should say happy Easter to all you Goyim out there.
Sorry, I always forget you're Jewish.
Wow. I'm going to react neutrally to that because there's like no reaction I could really have. It's not going to be problematic. It's the most Jewish thing you could be is like neurotic about your own Jewishness. You can't win. So Goyim love Easter is a thing that I have noticed throughout the years. Sam, are you doing anything for Easter with your Goyish family?
I'm just Googling what Goyim means.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's a Gentile. Okay. Oh, sometimes in a pejorative sense, I see.
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. I was just talking to people about this yesterday.
I was going to clean my house and maybe mop for the first time in 16 months.
For Easter specifically?
Yeah, for Easter, you know, to honor, you know, cleanliness is next to godliness.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't have any Easter plans this year.
Well,
I'm not really sure I ever have. I remember one time it fell on 420 and that was cool.
Yeah. 420. Nice.
Nice.
Did you do some 69ing as well?
No, but I did smoke pot and then ate, you know,
some candy, some of those Cadbury cum eggs that everyone loves so much. think about it. It really looks like cum. Does it not?
It does, but for some reason, cum is giving me the ick right now.
I mean, it's like, fine. It's not like...
This is our first cum reference on this podcast. It's not
like, you know, like, yum, yum, cum. But it's not like, you know, the worst thing in the world. It's just, it is what it is.
No, it's not the worst thing in the world. You're right about that.
it's fine.
What are you doing for Easter, Jamie?
I am recording this podcast and Googling when is Passover.
Nice.
Because, oh yeah, Passover is April 20. The Jewish holidays really like to jump around. It's April 22nd to April 30th this year. So that'll be
great.
You know, now that I know it's coming up, maybe I can actually plan for it. Like go to some kind of radical Seder. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Or maybe even visit my 100-year-old grandma in Westchester County, where she...
I think she would like that.
...is still, like, you know, living. She's good for her, man. Yeah, I don't know. I'm having a chill weekend with friends. Oh, but I feel like it's been a minute since we've had any updates from our love lives. And...
Yeah. How's your love life going? I deleted Tinder yesterday. That's my update, so...
So I took a little break from the apps after the last humiliation that happened. I was a little burnt out. But I recently learned a new term that applies to me. I read about it in Cosmo, and it is called ambiamorous.
Oh.
Do you know what that means?
No, explain more, please.
So ambiamorous is a person who can do either any kind of relationship. They can do a monogamous relationship, or they can do a non-monogamous romantic relationship. And, you know, you might be like, oh, does everything really need a word? Does everything really need like an identity attached
to it? Yes, that is precisely what I'm like. Yes.
Gen Z ass bullshit. But like, I don't know. I think it's okay. It's shorter than what I had been saying, which is, you know, I'll do whatever you want. Just please, please, please love me. So there you go.
Yeah, that's what I am.
So you're ambiamorous too.
No, I refuse to use that word. Give it a month and then I'll start saying I absolutely am. But I'm stuck behind a paywall on Cosmo right now. So I have no, I don't have space for that shit.
Yeah, I think I read like the first half of the article before the paywall kicked in.
You are an expert then.
Yeah, I'm an expert in ambiamory. Otherwise known as, you know, being a simp for love. But like, yeah, I can vibe it out. I'll do whatever the situation, I'll do whatever feels right, you know? I'm not like one of those people who's like, I am monogamous as an identity or I am polyamorous as an identity, you know, because different relationships might unfold in different ways. I will say I don't have the energy for like full polyamory. But, yeah. You know, I can have a little open relationship as a treat.
Sure. Yeah, totally.
A little non-monogamy.
I mean, it's also like, these are questions that like change form and change answer over time in accordance with like your life circumstances as well. Like you might find yourself in a place where you do have logistical capacity and emotional capacity for polyamory or something like that. Okay. Ambiamory is growing on me a little bit.
It's like
I'm not
going to
stake my flag in that yet.
It's like, you know, someone who can write with both hands. You can like jack two guys off at the same time. You're ambiamorous.
Oh, I can do that. Hit my line, y'all.
Humans have two hands, you know? Might as well use them. Wow, this got a bit bluer than I expected it to. Sorry.
Yeah, we've already talked about cum and penises.
Oh boy. Well, I mean, it's good to be back doing a classic Party Girls episode after all the serious ones that we had to do.
Yeah. It's nice to be back.
Oh, I also wanted to note, if you are a comrade in good standing, I will never talk about you without your permission on the podcast or in my act. So there you go. I want to try dating comrades now, I think.
Good. That's news to me, actually.
The apolitical dude in a band didn't work out so well.
No, I don't suppose it would.
my friend I was telling about him, it was like, is he political at all? I was like, no. Why? She's like, Jamie.
I'm trying to start a band, kind of like for fans of Dead Kennedy and Nicki Minaj.
Oh, what?
We'll get into that later.
That sounds awesome.
Hell yeah.
I'm sold.
My friend bought a crib and there's a garage and we're going to convert it into a music studio.
Oh, fun.
So I'm excited.
Oh, now yeah. I'm so excited to come visit you in Chicago at some point.
Maybe when I play my first show.
Oh, yeah. That would be so fun.
Yeah, that'd be sick. I tried multiple times to get booked during the music festivals at Defend the Atlanta Forest, and I never made the cut. So, you know, got to keep grinding, I guess.
Yeah, gotta stay on that grind. Well, speaking of grinding, now I don't know. That's a terrible transition. We have some...
You could have said speaking of Defend the Atlanta Forest, but...
We have some exciting news!
What's that?
On Easter, he is risen. Oh my goodness. John Mazurek, a.k.a. Jack, who is a member of the movement to defend the Atlanta Forest in Atlanta, making him our comrade, has been released from prison.
Woohoo!
Fwah, 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 fwah. And you can edit in some air horns there.
So Jack was arrested was probably in custody for a month and a half about after the raids that happened in Atlanta in early February. Jack's private residence, a home that he owns, was raided, and Jack was arrested allegedly in connection with an arson of police motorcycles that occurred in the summer of 2023 during the sixth week of action.
Yeah. You want me to just read? I'm going to read what the Atlanta Community Press Collective said about it. So,
oh, great.
John Jack Mazurek was granted a $75,000 cash only bond on Friday. And the way bonds work, they probably only have to pay 10% of that, actually, which is still a lot of money. But a lot of people have been sending in donations for Jack's defense, which is really awesome. Mazurek is alleged to be responsible for the July 2023 arson of police motorcycles and has been in jail since February 8th. Prosecutors claim agents found DNA evidence from Mazurek on a bottle cap at the arson site. Mazurek will be placed on 24-hour house arrest, may not post on social media, and may not have contact with members of the Defend the Atlanta Forest movement, with the sole exception of his fiance. Aw, they're engaged. Mm. We're such lovebirds on this podcast. We just like, we see the word fiance and we're like, aw. Over 100 people were signed into the Zoom hearing, many of whom identified themselves as attending in support of Mazurek. According to Mazurek's attorney, the alleged DNA evidence brought forth against Mazurek is a, quote, moderate stringent or, quote, partial match to him. So not out of the woods yet. Obviously, Jack still has to face trial, but he is no longer being starved to death and confined in,
you know, house arrest. I'm sure is a pain in the ass and probably sucks during the hearing themselves. You know, the prosecutor and the judge said that no members of the Defend the Atlanta Forest organization can be in communication with Jack. And it's still this sort of like the state's inability to conceptualize that it's not an organization or something like that. Like, what does that even mean? Like, if you've attended discussion about it as an attendee in the audience, are you a member of the org? If you've tweeted about Stopping Cop City, are you a member of the organization? Like, how many protests do you need to go to before you're a member of the organization? Is all 116,000 people who signed the referendum, are those members, you know, or is it only the people who were in City Hall for over 2 hours and 45 minutes and then you're a member? You know, it's like it's really vague, probably purposely so. But I can imagine that's going to cause tensions, you know. That being said, is an immense wave of relief sort of surged through my body when I heard that Mazurek was able to go home, where like if bond was denied there, you know, there's a chance that Jack would have been locked up until after the trial's over. So the fact that that didn't occur is huge. To be able to go home and sleep in your own bed, be surrounded by your comfort objects, listen to your records, or, you know, eat your cereal is I hope huge, you know?
Yeah, it's a huge relief. And also I think there's some interesting stuff to talk about here in terms of how this went down. Like you said, Defend the Atlanta Forest as a movement is not a membership organization. And the state really doesn't seem to be able to wrap its mind around that still. They are still leaning on the idea that this is like some group, a small group of anarchist militants. They're really leaning on the anarchism as well in an effort to criminalize an ideology. And they make it look much more centralized, organized, and, you know, hierarchical than it actually is, because that's the only way that they can conceive of anything, of a movement. Like, there's been a number of statements from various government officials in Atlanta. But I think the arguments of the prosecutor were interesting because they really are leaning hard on anarchism as an ideology, which is a continuation of the strategy they used in the RICO cases, where if you read the indictments, it's a lot of it seems like it's copy-pasted from the Wikipedia article on anarchism, right? And they brought in two interesting things that are both subjects of interest to us on this podcast, the first of which is the Zapatistas. So I'm going to read what Defend the Atlanta Forest, Stop Cop City said about it on Twitter. Quote, "At Jack's arraignment, the state dedicated 15 minutes to analysis, debate, and denunciations of the Zapatistas, a Mexico-based movement Jack is said to have visited in January. The prosecutor went so far as to threaten war with the indigenous group." That's right. The United States Army and perhaps the Mexican state is going to go to war with the Zapatistas over this. Yeah.
I'd like to imagine it's just Fulton County.
Oh, and I believe they used the word autonomous zone in these arguments, which is a very like Tucker Carlson brained way to talk about it. So the thread continues.
Yeah.
Who
like
are
six
they
times.
And why does Georgia care? And then there's a little history of the Zapatistas, which I will read for anyone who doesn't know who they are. On January 1st, 1994, thousands of Maya campesinos and students rose up in arms in Chiapas, Mexico, against the famously corrupt Mexican government and the newly signed NAFTA agreements, which would impoverish and endanger their communities. After 12 days, the Ejército Zapatista Liberación Nacional and the state of Mexico called a ceasefire and initiated peace talks known as the San Andres, bringing peace, recognition, protection, and land to the indigenous peoples of all of Mexico. For the past 30 years, thousands of Zapatistas have organized workshops, farms, schools, shops, festivals, and villages in the spirit of communalist, egalitarian self-rule. On January 1st of this year, thousands of people from around the world convened in Chiapas to celebrate the anniversary of the Zapatista uprising. Jack is alleged to be one of those thousands of students, artists, intellectuals, and empathetic people. Currently, the Zapatistas face new challenges as drug traffickers and paramilitaries threaten and kill Zapatista women and youth who do not permit alcohol, drugs, or violence in their communities. The Mexican government also aims to build a train, the Train Maya, in their lands. This project will allow the government to place armed forces across the area, violating the San Andres Accords, jeopardizing the safety of the region for the purposes of profits, and at the behest of the USA, who hope to push the system of border checkpoints south into the Yucatan. Since 1994, the Zapatistas have inspired generations of dreamers and activists across the world, representing the new era of post-Cold War resistance to exploitation, state terrorism, global capitalism, and violence. The city of Atlanta and the state of Georgia are opposed to those movements because they have dedicated considerable resources to training, arming, and funding counter-revolutionaries, terrorists, narco-traffickers, and paramilitaries in Central America and at the School of the Americas. And that pits them directly against freedom movements like the Zapatistas, as well as our movement to stop Cop City and to defend as well as rebuild the Huilani Forest. If this is the accusation, Jack's family should be proud of his alleged attendance at their ceremony. For more info, we recommend Rebellion in Chiapas by John Womack Jr., A Place Called Chiapas, a documentary film available online, and this article from participants in our very own movement who attended the 2024 Encuentro. And there's a link to an article in Crime Think titled The 2024 Zapatista Encuentro. And yeah, it's like a nice report back, a little description of what happened at this convergence, at this event. And it's very different from what the prosecutor is trying to make it out to be, when they claimed that Jack was training with paramilitaries at this autonomous zone, right? You scroll down, you look at what actually happened. Oh, look, they're putting on a play. Oh, look, they're hanging there. They have a memorial for Tortuguita. They're hanging out. They're talking to each other about, you know, various struggles in different places. They're eating together. They're, you know, sleep. They're camping out. This is, you know, not exactly the nest of terrorists that the state wants you to think.
No. And I was attending the bond hearing on Zoom. And as it got closer and closer to the judge's decision, the state started trying to mobilize this Zapatista Chiapas argument harder and harder, going as far as saying that Jack allegedly has such deep connections with the Zapatistas in Chiapas that he poses a flight risk and could flee to this area and never come back home. And that you could tell just sort of by the judges, like the judge was just like, what are you talking about? A little bit, you know? And they did, as far as I remember properly, like take Jack's passport. But I mean, as far as I know, for higher profile things, that's pretty common practice.
So I'm pretty sure, correct me if I'm wrong here, there is really no precedent in recent history or, you know, deeper history for the Zapatistas to harbor an American political fugitive. It really does seem like sort of a fever dream. Not to say that they're not like internationally minded, right? The fact that they had this encuentro and invited people from all over the place shows that they want to at least be in contact with people all over the world. But, you know, they have their hands full with their own, they got a lot on their plates. They got their own shit to deal with. So the idea of, you know, provoking a response like that from the U.S. government, it doesn't seem like something that they would do. And there's no evidence that's what's going on.
In the hearing itself, there were a variety of folks who, and I might be getting the language wrong, but who testified or offered stories of their experience with Jack and Jack's ties to the community, as whether it be a sort of carpenter or an uncle or a friend or a volunteer at different organizations or something like that. But another one of the people that they pulled in was Professor Margaret Cerullo, professor of sociology and feminist studies at Hampshire College. And both the prosecutor and the defense, once again, I'm not sure if it's the right term, but like seemed to be like cross-examining this professor in the hearing itself, like asking her questions to elaborate on, as you sort of just read, the history of the Zapatistas and the nature of this encuentro and the nature of, like she's supposed to know this or something, but Jack's alleged relationship with the Zapatistas. And one thing that she really just sort of talked about is how the Zapatistas are of immense interest to scholars, intellectuals, and artists around the world. And folks regularly travel across the globe to sort of learn from this indigenous-led resistance movement and art and culture renaissance that's happening down there in Chiapas. And, you know, the Professor Cerullo really did quite an excellent job. Like, I learned a lot from what she had to say. And I think she did a very good job of just sort of explaining what this place is and what its significance is, its historical significance is around the globe.
Maybe we should get her on the podcast. Mm. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah,
I fucking love the Zapatistas. I think they're so rad. People who've been listening to me since the Antifada will know that I went to visit them one time a few years back.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fucking sick. And you know, everything in that town just makes sense. I went to Oventique. I forget what this episode is called, but you could probably just Google like Antifada, Chiapas, Zapatistas. But it was really fucking cool. And yeah, I guess some people want to claim them as anarchists. They don't identify explicitly that way. They're like, we're Zapatistas. It's its own thing. But it does really seem like a cool synthesis of, you know, very collectivist, ancient, indigenous, social culture combined with more modern, autonomous politics. So
one of the best gifts I ever got in my whole life was a bag, you know, a pound bag of Cafe Zapatista coffee that I believe that there's a cooperative or a collective down in Chiapas that grows and roasts and sort of sells in like a sort of national, international fundraising goal to raise money for schools and otherwise down there. This really lovely coffee from down there. And I knew so little about coffee that I was like holding on to the bag for like months and months and months and months and months because I was like, this is so special. I can't use it. And then, of course, one of my coffee snobs like looks at the roasted on date and was like, ew, you really should have drinking this several months ago.
Well, you live, you learn.
You live, you learn. But the Zapatistas weren't the only sort of international communist or revolutionary project or scene or thing that the prosecutor referenced in their case against denying Jack Bond.
No, no, it gets much more Tucker Carlson brained from here.
So I'm going to once again read a little bit from the Defend the Atlanta Forest Stop Cop City Twitter. But during Jack's bond hearing today, I guess this would have been Friday, the prosecutor made special mention of books and materials authored by the Invisible Committee. The most famous text that they wrote was The Coming Insurrection. These books, he claimed, are authored by anonymous French activists. Who are they and why does the state of Georgia care? A thread.
Why indeed?
It's odd that of all the materials ostensibly in Jack's house, the prosecutor found special interest in these. For some unclear reason, he seemed to insinuate that possession of these books, which folks should know can be bought at any corporate bookstore. I've literally picked up a copy of one of these books at Barnes & Noble in person without having to special
order it. I bought this shit on Amazon, okay?
Was reason enough to deny Bond. The Invisible Committee was an anonymous group of French activists participating in social movements in French and European defense of cultural centers, resistance to racist police violence, environmentalism, and protests against neoliberal austerity measures in France, which folks may know France loves their neoliberal austerity.
And
measures.
Hates them as well.
And hates them as well. So what is this and what are the connections to it? So this group, the Invisible Committee, who authored The Coming Insurrection, To Our Friends, Now, and a few other pieces over the years, although they haven't put out anything for a long time, if they still even exist.
Who's to say?
A group of like 10 or a dozen, like 22 to 35 year olds who were thought to be in the Invisible Committee by the French government, moved from Paris and from the cities to a small village called Tarnac in the French countryside. They purchased a small grocer and they like had small little, you know, beautiful homes that they just sort of lived simple lives in, lives without technology, without cell phones, without social media, where they just sort of returned to the earth and opened a grocery store, maybe a pub, and just sort of like did this small town lifestyle thing. Well, in 2008, anti-terror police in France did this massive multi-hundred officer raid, like a mega raid in the middle of the night, descending onto this tiny little quaint village in the mountains in order to arrest a group of 9 activists that they claim were responsible for sabotaging high-speed rail lines by taking these horseshoe-shaped pieces of metal and laying them across the cables on top of the rails that traversed the country. With no evidence whatsoever, the French government like swoops into this quaint little village and arrests these 9 people who became known as the Tarnac 9, eventually the Tarnac 10. And some of the evidence that they used against these folks were they didn't have cell phones and therefore were criminals because they didn't have cell phones. Uh-huh.
If you do have a cell phone, they're like, you are against capitalism and yet you have a cell phone. And if you don't, they don't like that either.
There's no winning with these fuckers, is there, JB? What it ended up being, the Tarnac 10 trial ended up being the longest anti-terror trial in French history, which resulted in 0 convictions. We'll post a couple things in the show notes, but you can read some statements, updates, and articles written by some of the accused and their supporters in the show notes. But by linking Jack to another anti-terror environmentalist case on the international circuit, prosecutors hope to paint a picture of an international criminal. For whatever ridiculous reason, the prosecutor claimed that Jack is a leader in the Defend the Atlanta Forest movement, and we can only imagine why prosecutors would take special interest in these works. So beyond everything, this commentary is another example of the state of Georgia making recourse to ridiculous speculation and storytelling as methods of criminalizing free speech, the right to protest, the freedom to travel, to associate, and to organize in general. And what some folks I've heard over the years, even prior to the Defend the Atlanta Forest movement, was what was at stake in the Tarnak 9 case was the criminalization of certain types of relationships, certain types of bonds. So they were saying that this was a sort of, this term ultra left, it was being mobilized by the French government in this like anti-terror campaign against these, these quiet villagers living in the mountains who were allegedly part of some vast conspiracy to sabotage rail lines and publishing the most dangerous book of the late aughts, which folks might remember Glenn Beck held up on his show next to Mao's Little Red Book saying, "Parents, if you see your kids with the coming insurrection, you need to send them to military school."
Yeah, he called it the most dangerous book in the world. And he said, everyone should read this book because you need to know what's in it. You need to know what the enemies of the state, of the people, of traditional values of America are saying. And it made this book from this obscure, you know, French ultra-left tendency, it made it a surprise bestseller, which is pretty funny.
It literally slingshotted it onto the New York Times list.
Some people that I may or may not know did a guerrilla reading of it in the Union Square Barnes & Noble, I believe, around that time. So that's...
OMG, you may or may not know those people. I've read accounts of that online.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
So the Zapatista thing, this invisible committee thing, this argument by the prosecutors condemning anarchism as such, condemning connections with international activists and revolutionaries, condemning ideas, you know, it really brings up the like 109-page RICO indictment and just the bizarre, like, you know, as you sort of pointed out, the parallels with the first Red Scare, this time just against the Black Flag. And it's really quite chilling.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my boy Karl Marx said it best, that history repeats itself. The first time is tragedy, the second is farce. I think I got that quote pretty well. And yeah, I just listened to a really interesting episode of It's Going Down, which is a podcast where they had on a historian of the IWW talking about some of the parallels between this and the first Red Scare, which of course happened around the time of World War I, when the IWW, especially the Industrial Workers of the World, which was at the time a very large and powerful and radical union that was pretty anarchist in its orientation, and it's still around, by the way, but they used these laws like the Espionage Act and criminal, quote, criminal syndicalism laws, right? Because these folks were anarcho-syndicalists. They used these laws to go after anti-war dissenters. They accused the anti-war dissenters of, you know, working for Germany or whatever, which, you know, what did Nancy Pelosi say the other day to the anti-war protesters who were protesting the war in Gaza? She like accused them for working for Russia or China.
Smooth brain.
Yeah. They also killed people, including Frank Lindell, who was an IWW organizer assassinated in 1917 by probably a group of vigilantes and local police who were operating at the behest of the copper mining company. And, you know, obviously it's not a one-to-one comparison, but the IWW does still exist today, and Tortuguita was a member. So there are some very obvious through lines there, and the kind of fear-mongering, this combination, right, of fear-mongering, of just straight-up brutal violence, and lawfare, which is a tactic by which, you know, the repression is so bad that a lot of the movement's resources are tied up in trying to defend people, trying to get people out of jail, mounting legal defenses, which can be very expensive. And, you know, most importantly, we see this liberal democracy showing its true face, right? Violating all kinds of civil liberties before our very eyes that it claims it exists to protect. Turns out, when it feels threatened by anti-capitalists, those go out the window, and even liberals can be pretty fucking fascist. And actually, the ACLU was founded in part to defend the IWW against this kind of repression. Of course, it didn't really work.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the more you know. You learn a lot from listening to podcasts.
The ACLU's really fallen the fuck off then, if that's the case.
Yeah, no shit. But what do we think of this? Because, you know, obviously, I believe in civil liberties. I don't think this is something that should go out the window under communism. I think communism is actually the only way to truly honor people's civil liberties. But like, we are fucking around with some pretty radical ideas. And even though we are supposed to have freedom of expression, freedom of politics, freedom of communication, I think at this point in time, we should know to expect the state to respond in some very illiberal ways when we publicly try to think through and talk through what it would mean to overthrow capitalism and the state. Like, I don't think we should be surprised at this point when that happens, even though it's quote unquote not supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm surprised more people aren't sounding the alarm on this sort of stuff. I mean, of course, it's like there's the cognitive dissonance of the far right who, you know, supports free speech, unless, of course, it's leftist, anti-government, anti-capital speech. But, you know, there's not a lot of NGOs or liberals or even like leftist mainstream politicians sort of stepping up to the plate to push back against this contemporary Red Scare that we're seeing. And, you know, we kind of see, once again, the only people who are offering any sort of meaningful resistance or thoughtful criticism for this thing are the people who are most affected by it.
Yeah. So what do we think of this media project then? Like, where do we find the balance between, on the one hand, you know, wanting to discuss and spread ideas and spread tactics and analyze things that have happened on the ground, whether we're talking about the movement to defend the forest or something else? And how do we keep people safe? How do we safeguard against repression when we're so outmatched in terms of power?
I mean, that's one of the reasons why I finally decided to just say fuck it and do it and become a podcaster and give speeches where I like say my fucking truth, regardless of how dangerous it is to say it, is because I do believe that we need people. We need more people doing this type of stuff. Like, we're in a beeline towards fascism, and they're trying to bludgeon us into dank submission. And we need more people stepping up to the plate and saying, fuck this. I'm not going down without a fight. This is what I believe. This is why I believe it. And doing so in a way to where, so like, as we continue this rightward trajectory, that we can maintain a sort of drumbeat of brave and courageous discourse that like is rooted upon these like supposedly quintessential American values of free speech and the First Amendment and things like that. And like, we've got this here in the United States. We best be using it, you know? And I do get worried, you know, after these raids occurred. I start worrying about, you know, like, they do this because they want this ripple effect of fear to just sort of radiate throughout the movement. And I'm not going to lie and say that I'm not scared, you know? Like, sometimes I'm not always scared, but sometimes I am like, oh shit, there's a picture of a burning cop car behind me. They sure don't like that. If I'm ever on trial for something, they're sure going to talk about that. And like, thankfully, I, you know, I purposely don't break laws. So I'm like, I'm now like doing this media thing, this comms thing, and I've never been a lawbreaker, and I don't break laws. So I don't have that to worry about, but the state doesn't care. if you're actually breaking a law or not. They're trying to paint this vast international criminal conspiracy against the police, which began, if folks will recall, I don't know if we talked about this yet on this show, but in the 109-page RICO indictment that came out, there's a date. There is a date that they say that the Defend the Atlanta Forest movement began. And that is May 25th, 2020, the day that George Floyd was murdered by the police in Minneapolis. And they say that in the RICO indictment, that that's the day that Defend the Atlanta Forest came into being. And it's just like, I don't know if it's just like wild incompetence or if it's a bunch of like conspiracy-brained shit, or if these people actually believe that.
Well, the plans to build Cop City had not even been made public yet at that point in time. So that feels like they're really tipping their hand as to what this is actually about, right?
Yeah. Where it's like the number one constituted force in the United States, the wall of linebackers that we have to get past in order to be able to establish roots in the world and like let the roots of freedom grow, is the police. Like everything in this world that we want is on the other side of police control. And like they know that. And that's why since 2020, they're doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on police infrastructure and police training facilities and cop cities around the country, because they know that. They know that the only thing between us and freedom is the police, and they have to prevent that at all costs. And that's why I think it's important to speak up against this stuff.
Yeah. I do worry a little bit because, you know, on the one hand, I think it's important to talk about our long-term political horizon, why we're doing the things we do, why we think this is so important, and, you know, various tactics, and, you know, connect them up as much as we can to various types of praxis, including the fight to stop Cop City, and, you know, really think through these things. And like, even before I really had drawn some connections between it and my, you know, long-term political goals, I was attracted to this movement in particular because a lot of the people shared similar politics to my own. But like, it's also kind of, it's easy for us to say, right, when we are not living in Atlanta and we are not at risk of being raided to the degree that people in Atlanta are. And, you know, I worry that the things that, because it's such a large decentralized movement, right? The things that some people say, the things that some people talk about, or even the things that some people do might come down on other people who don't even know that that stuff is happening.
And that's what the state's been trying to do. I mean, even in Jack's hearing the other day, the state was talking about the prosecutor attempted to say that these people who are charged with domestic terrorism, that their alleged actions should be taken into consideration when deciding whether or not to deny Jack bond. And the judge sort of outright said, no, that's not what this thing is, you know? But the states, and it's like, for me, it's like the parallels between the Defend the Atlanta Forest trials and the J20 trials during the Donald Trump era are uncanny, where one of the things that the state's trying to do is say it doesn't matter if you specifically did this thing or not. You're a part of a conspiracy, of a conspiratorial organization, of a racketeering influence corrupt organization, RICO. And therefore, the actions of other people you are responsible for legally. And it's this, like, the reason why the RICO came into being was to get folks like Al Capone or something like that, who didn't off people themselves, but by saying, because you gave money to someone who gave money to someone to take out a hit on somebody, Al Capone, you are responsible for this because of this web of financial interest. And they're taking that same sort of logic and applying it to activist movements that are trying to prevent the end of life on Earth itself and trying to fight for a better world and dignified life for people. And they're saying that someone way over there in this corner, this obscure sector of the movement, allegedly committed criminal activity in the same goal as what you over here, who gave $124 to help build a porta potty during, you know, a convergence in the forest. All of you are operating within the same sort of conspiratorial organization, and therefore you're all guilty. And it's like, this is a very significant court case for that regard. And we, like, the reason why people are fighting so hard against this is because it will set a fucked up precedent going into the next several decades of our lives. If we can let the state successfully make this ludicrous argument.
Yeah. I mean, they're very much relying too on coding. Well, okay. So first they want to isolate the anarchists in the movement, and they've tried, and it's like kind of a good tactic if I was the state, right? Like, they are ignoring the, for instance, I don't know, the masses of Black women that have protested against Cop City. Like, there was a demonstration recently at Mayor Andre Dickens's house. A bunch of Black women from Atlanta showed up very early in the morning to protest Cop City. They tend to ignore protests of that nature and focus on people they can paint as, you know, white extremists, preferably from out of state, right? Although in this case, Jack does live in Atlanta, and say, look, this is a tiny group. It is not a mass movement. Everybody else should fear them. And it's very much relying on a certain coding of what anarchists believe as being fundamentally evil, right? Fundamentally against public safety, because they're saying this is the public safety training center. I'll read a quote from fucking Sheerbaum. What's his name? Who is he again?
Chief Sheerbaum, yeah.
Police Chief Darren Sheerbaum at a press conference where he said, the people of Atlanta deserve to be protected by well-trained, well-equipped first responders. You can chant all day long, if you build it, we will burn it. But if you set police cars on fire, we're going to find you and we're going to arrest you. So first of all, you cannot chant that all day long and expect not to be fucked with by the cops. The cops have fucked with all kinds of nonviolent protesters throughout the history of this movement. Even, I mean, I guess they're not doing violence to the referendum, but they're definitely doing repression on it and have effectively, it's like, okay, if you want us to go through the proper democratic channels, maybe you shouldn't make the referendum dead in the water by having a legal strategy of delaying it so far that it never happens. So that's like sort of a false dichotomy, right? Between good protesters and bad protesters, the ones who have civil liberties and the ones who don't.
One of the things that I think the state really did not foresee in this movement, and one of the movement's greatest strengths, which I think is ushering in, which I hope, and this will take the work of everybody listening to this podcast and all of our loved ones, but I think is ushering in a paradigm shift in social movements, is the state has unsuccessfully fractured the movement. The state has been unsuccessful in getting different sectors of the movement to verbally chastise and critique and delegitimize other sectors. And therefore, all of the delegitimization has to be done by the police, who nobody trusts in the first place. So, like, they're working overtime on this, like, anti-anarchist Red Scare, kind of precisely because the other sectors of the movement aren't doing that work for them. And like that phenomenon alone, if that can percolate and propagate over the rest from now on into other social movements, it's hard to even put into words how much better that will make everybody in the movement. And it's like, it goes back to this sort of like no good cops, no bad protesters argument, which sort of really came to the fore during the George Floyd rebellion, and then Defend the Atlanta Forest and Stop Cop City movements kind of like grabbed that flag and ran with it. And then every single sector in the movement, for the most part, has refused to publicly throw under the bus other parts of the movement. And it's just like, we see it over and over and over and over again. And I think that reason is why the state is just like scrambling and scrounging in the carpet fibers, trying to find some sort of anti-anarchist argument. And it's like, I don't entirely know how to talk about all of this, but there is something there and something interesting where it's like, this country, and obviously like this country's origins are not morally righteous or pure and are filled with all sorts of fucked up shit, but like, this country was founded through revolution, you know? And it's like, revolution and being able to resist the government is supposedly, once again, a quintessential trait of what it means to be an American. And like, I know there's something there, and I know that it's filled with contradictions, whether it be in what I just said or in how we see that phenomenon expressed during some of these supposedly patriotic segments of the population who like are the bootlickers, right? The cognitive dissonance of the bootlickers. But revolution is as American as apple pie. And we need to follow that line and not let them make revolution into a dirty word.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I've got no problem with using the United States' own rhetoric against it. Maybe I'm being sincere. Maybe I'm just showing how hypocritical the founding documents of our country have turned out to be. But, you know, if there is some good stuff in there, I think it's disingenuous. But like I was just talking about rights, I was talking about civil liberties. Yeah, I'm not one of those communists who thinks that rights are bad. Like, I did a whole episode on looking at what the Soviets had to say about abortion, actually, of Everybody Loves Communism. I read some writings of Alexander Kollontai and was sort of arguing with the guys because, you know, they were sort of looking around for some justification for why people should be allowed to have abortions that wasn't on some level the language of these individual rights, these bourgeois rights. And I really couldn't figure anything else out besides like maybe the way we should talk about it is collective rights is, you know, it's like, oh, I mean, why should someone who can't get pregnant care that people who can are allowed to get an abortion? Because you want to live in a society where everyone has bodily autonomy. And, you know, maybe that's where the anarchist in me comes in, but I think that's pretty fucking important. And that's something that we need to have more of and not less. And, you know, these founding ideas of our country, these ideas of freedom and whatnot, I think in progressing to the next phase, I'm being optimistic now, the founding ideas of whatever comes next should be, oh yeah, these things, but for real.
That gets into the whole constitution question and destitution question, which I can't wrap my feeble brain around today.
Yeah, no, we don't have to talk about it today. I'm pretty tired, but it is definitely an interesting discussion because I think it's something where you and I differ.
Yeah. So I'm just feeling really grateful that Jack is back home and that Jack can spend time in his house and with his fiance, and that, you know, the states, they didn't secure the victory that the prosecution was hoping that they were going to secure, which was drawing largely on this sort of Red Scare phenomenon. And I guess we'll just, you know, we'll keep folks posted about how this plays out as we go into the future. This is a long fight, that a long legal battle that's going to happen. As far as I know, sometime in the summer is when the first RICO defendants and DT defendants will be getting the legislative legal process rolling for them. We'll post a couple ways that folks can support Jack's legal defense as well as other legal defense elements of the movement.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. We'll put a link in the show notes and we will keep you updated as things develop.
So, you know, one thing that I wanted to pivot into
the non-cop city portion of our podcast.
Yeah. The more magical portion of our lives is a week from tomorrow is going to be a total solar eclipse, which will be traversing the United States from the southwest to the northeast. And I strongly recommend anybody who is within driving distance of the path of totality, make it there. There is no pun intended night and day difference between being a 99% totality and being in 100% totality. So look it up, make it happen, call into work, and experience a total solar eclipse. Here in Illinois, it's especially important, specifically in Southern Illinois, in the area near Carbondale. So back in 2017, there was the folks might remember another total solar eclipse that went from the, you know, the Pacific Northwest and cut downward towards the southeast of the United States. And the mathematical epicenter of this total solar eclipse, meaning the point in which the longest point of duration of totality, the mathematical center of the eclipse was in this little tiny town in Southern Illinois called Macanda, population 600. Fast forward to now, this next total solar eclipse has the mathematical center in the exact same location. This is called the Crossroads Eclipse. And I was living in Carbondale during this first total solar eclipse. And it was all the rage for a lot of reasons. But one of them is that over the grand history of the human experience, total solar eclipses have, across cultures, symbolized a time of cosmic and existential and social upheaval and change. And sometimes it's because people didn't know what the fuck a solar eclipse was, and then it happens. And other times it's because during these solar eclipses around the globe, there had been, they'd had such profound spiritual, social, political, and cultural significance to populations that they've brought to the fore, brought into being social unrest, social upheaval, and sort of revolution, cultural or otherwise. So down in Carbondale, after the first eclipse in the summer of 2017, an anonymous text emerged called The Next Eclipse. We'll post the notes to that on the notes. I think it's published on Ill Will, although that wasn't originally where it came out. And it sort of asked, but it made a claim that between now, 2017, and the next eclipse in 2024, we are going to try to build regional autonomy here in Southern Illinois. And it sort of asked the question, what if an eclipse is something that we become? Ooh. What if two eclipses is something that we do? And during that time in 2017, there was an autonomous march that happened and took over the strip in Carbondale, Illinois. And at the helm of the march was a banner that read, "This empire too will be eclipsed."
Ooh.
And currently there are conspiracy theories circulating over the internet that the end of the world will begin next Monday, the 8th, in Carbondale at 1:59 p.m. Central Standard Time during the moment of totality. So I guess we'll see.
Wow. I mean, TBD. I mean, it's pretty soon, so.
TBD.
We'll know soon enough. Although, you know, it could be like the 2012 people who, you know, 2012 came and went and there was no, you know, Quetzalcoatl didn't come eat us. But they were like, you know, no, you just didn't perceive the apocalypse because you're not like tuned into the right wavelength, man. You just need more crystals. Mm.
I mean, the world's a hell of a lot more fucked up than it was in 2012.
It's true. It seems pretty quaint now that people thought that that was going to be the apocalypse. There was so much left to come.
Yeah.
And there still is so much left to come. I like the concept of an eclipse to mark time. You know, like why do people care about New Year's Eve? I don't know, because human beings experience time linearly, generally, and we like to take moments to look back, look ahead at where we want to go. Also, it is the title of influential, well, If you're on the ultra left, an influential text by Gilles Dauvet called The Eclipse and Reemergence of the Communist Movement, which I did an episode on way back of the Antifada, which is an influential text of communization theory. It definitely influenced a lot of the stuff that we've been reading, talking about, you know, in Habit. You can draw a pretty straight line from one to the other. Or, you know, nothing is ever straightforward with ultra-leftists, but, you know, you can draw like a wacky line from one to the other. And we tried to get the hashtag going, hashtag read the moon book, but nobody knew what the fuck we were talking about. So we gave up. But maybe it could still happen. I don't know. And like, I'm not like fully wholeheartedly endorsing it. Like, parts of it made sense to me and parts of it read like galaxy-brained anarchist nonsense. But I definitely like fuck with it.
One of the things that I've been sort of trying to recover in over the last few years of my life, honestly, especially since I got a smartphone like 10 years ago, I'd say that my spiritual tethering to the cosmos and to this earth, even just feeling embedded in life, has been chiseled away at by the way that I think screens have reshaped my brain. And it's really sort of pushed out, bullied out of the way, an ability to find wonder and magic in my life. And I've never really had a spiritual tethering to the world. I've always been agnostic or atheist. And there were moments in 2007 when I like learned about Woodstock and the hippies and meditation and, you know, Buddhism and things like that. And I experimented with that, you know, as a preteen. But like, I've never really had a spiritual foundation, and I've never really been one that for whom like rituals have clicked, you know? And for me, I'm really trying to be open to these, to ritual, to magic, to spiritual significance, to things, you know, like astrology. I don't know anything about astrology. I don't care about astrology, but I love what astrology does for people. That's fucked up to say.
I'm sorry. It's a
religion. It's a spiritual tethering to the world. And I don't think that we're allowed to make judgmental, qualitative value judgments on that kind of shit.
Well, but I just did. Sorry.
Yeah. Well,
it really annoys
me. Like, what I love about it though. Go ahead.
It just, this is one of my fucking pet peeves. Okay. Like with a lot, like when I used to be in DSA, you know, these are people that I like study with. That I study like historical materialism with, who I respect as Marxists, as materialists. And they start talking about astrology like they really believe it. It's like you just ripped off your face and I thought we had a lot in common, but I know nothing. I know nothing about you and we do not think about the world in the same way at all. It's not very materialist. I'll say that much.
I don't even know what materialism is. We live in existential and spiritual desert, you know, where we are disconnected from planet Earth, disconnected from one another, disconnected to any sense that there's a higher power or sense of spiritual significance. And that's a paradigmatic shift from how human beings move through the world for hundreds of thousands of years. And that's not an insignificant paradigmatic shift. And what I sort of understand with this contemporary, largely like oftentimes queer, like resurgence towards astrology, which once again, I don't know anything about and have zero plans to ever learn about. I'm a Taurus, is like, it's an attempt to rekindle and reconnect oneself to the cosmos and to sort of stake your claim that like, I have cosmic significance in this world. And it's a way to like, to just feel a spiritual tethering to life. And I respect that. I respect the desire to feel like a spiritually significant being. And there's all these questions that like materialism or whatever won't answer. Maybe you can try to find them in physics or something like that, but like this doesn't concern itself with such earthly affairs, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can't explain, like, what are we doing here? What is the meaning of life? What's my purpose? You can't explain a lot with science, but you can explain a lot more than we used to be able to. So I'm not going to...
Allegedly.
Oh, our producer has appeared.
I turn on the camera to log on as the astrology defender.
Oh my
as
God. Well. Yes.
Not that I like believe in it, but I think it's worth thinking about in terms of like harm reduction, like as an alternative, as like a methadone to say Christianity or something like that.
Sure.
Because it's really harmless. And so, you know, I think it's kind of fun, you know? And I'm like an Aries, Sag Aries. So I'm like all fire signs. I think it kind of lines up to me. But, you know, also, wait, while I'm on the topic of defending things, can I also log on as the cum defender? Because I was really upset at myself for muting my mic at the beginning of the show to hear all this cum slander of you all being like, it's fine, it's fine.
It's okay, fine.
It's a delicious, nutritious snack. Oh. You know, and that's all I got. I'll be taking my question
Andrew,
off the air.
Andrew cum defender Calloway.
Andrew has planted his flag.
Fuck yeah.
Astrology and...
cum flag.
And cum. Yeah, no, like, I don't talk about astrology and shit that much because I just want... It's very important that no one is ever mad at me. And it is a thing that tends to make people mad at me. So why would I want to do that? But no, it's fucking... It's true. Like, all these new agey beliefs, the nicest thing I can say about them is they're pretty harmless. No one's ever, like, fought wars over it or, like, you know... enslaved entire groups of people with that as the justification. Although, you know, just you wait, if certain new agey people get into power, they might make a gulag for all the Virgos or whatever.
Hopefully the Scorpios.
Because as we know, you know, the content of a religious text is not as important as the people in power and how they choose to deploy it. So if people can do horrible violence who claim to be Buddhists, like, I don't know, man. Why not? Sky's the limit. But anyway, my take on the eclipse, I don't really have one, but I did read an article. I mean, you're talking about wonder, right? And how everyone should have access to this if they want it. There was an article in Hellgate, which is a good sort of left populist worker-owned publication in New York, about how inmates in New York correctional facilities want to be allowed to watch the eclipse happen. And the state is responding with a system-wide lockdown where everyone is going to be locked in their cells for like 3 hours on the day of the eclipse. So there you have it. It all comes back to fucking the carceral state, to cop cities everywhere, to the prison industrial complex, to say who and who does not have access to this kind of wonder. And, you know, to some degree, their full humanity, if that's, you know, part of it for you.
There's something so deeply sinister about the American police, where they've sort of staked their flag as the enemy of human nature and becoming and existential joy and experience. Like, there's already nothing that you can do that's more wicked than taking somebody's body and locking it inside of a cage and preventing them from moving, from traversing this rock that we live on. That's already the most evil thing that you can do. And to say, in response to a request by inmates to experience a fundamental expression of the patterns / the entropy of the cosmos, of the world, to experience the universe, universing, and for your response to be, we're doing a system-wide lockdown to prevent you from getting even that bit of connection to your being alive, during a historically significant cosmic event in the solar system and in the Milky Way, and to be like, fuck you, hell no. Like, that is why we're fighting these fuckers.
Yeah, if anyone is ontologically evil, it's the people doing that.
Yes.
Not the people trying to fucking save the trees.
Oh. So go view the eclipse, because the state of New York won't let the prisoners do that. And if you can, try to make a commitment to yourself during that, that you never tell anybody about what you want to achieve in this life and why. And, you know, let's face this world together. Let's face this universe together.
Hi, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Party Girls. And now it's time to ask you for money. So if you really like the show and you want to support it, you can sign up at patreon.com/partygirls. And this will not only earn you the satisfaction of supporting independent leftist media, it will also give you access to our Discord community, which is like a cool private chat room for cool people only, where you can talk about the show and whatever else you like. And it's been really cool to see this slowly start to fill up with people, some of whom I recognize from before. Also, we'll give you a shout out on the show, which I'm going to do right now with the four new members who have signed up since the last time we did this. So I'm going to work back chronologically. We have Kyle Brown Watson. Thank you, Kyle. We have Bigger Bird. Thank you so much. Eric Phillips. Thank you, Eric. And PJ. Thank you for your support. And yeah, we'll hopefully have some bonus content coming soon for patrons as well. I get messages from the stars.